Thank you very much for your presentations. Let's give the president a round of applause. So now, while you're getting ready to potentially have some questions, you can either give them to me on a piece of paper, or you can just stand up and speak into the microphones. Let me try to just comment a little bit on what I've heard from our three speakers. So architectures of participation, the hallmark of Web 2.0, there's lots of participation which we have here. Oh My News, for instance, last night we had dinner with a person for Oh My News, which is a wonderful example of citizen journalism. So if people from Oh My News might have some comments here, we would love to hear them, how they think, you know, that part of people contributing actually is happening and being starting here in Korea. Interaction, architectures of interaction. We heard beautiful examples here from Kaneko-san on Mobech, on essentially still, as I just learned from you, it becoming a dating company. Mixi, of course, is really about interaction, I think. We heard beautiful example from Yahoo that knowledge search, while at least if I, as a non-Korean reader, look at Yahoo Answers in the United States, at first sight, it might be about knowledge, but actually, it's just like other things about people sort of hooking up, wasting time, dating, you know, that kind of complex. Much so, more so, at least in the West, than it's about knowledge. So both of those point towards community. And that's something where I really would like the panel to reflect a little bit. Sam gave beautiful examples about community in China. And I would like to know, why did it originate in China? Is it the depth that Chinese culture, Asian cultures are more about communities, Western cultures are more about individualisms, or are there deeper things? How, for instance, is collective intelligence, where people really collaborate to produce something, how is that different in the different countries here within Asia? Is there lots of collaboration happening in Japan? Or maybe because of the density of the living space, people in the subway sitting there and not collaborating much. So these are some questions I have in these areas of architecture of participation, interaction, and community. So whoever wants to start. Sam, all right.
Well, first, I wouldn't say that China originated the community concept. I think its community has been around since the very, very early days of the internet, even in the 80s, when I was in the States, maybe in the 80s, and in university, using a big fax system to have instant messaging with my friend in California, on the East Coast. So it's not, I don't think it didn't originate in China, but I do think that it became very mainstream in China very quickly, or from the very early days of the internet. The people who started the internet in China, the Sina and Sohu, they were engineers. Okay? And engineers were already participating in communities in the West to get information, so when they set up portals, the VBS, the online communities, became a big part of that. Later today, I think we're hearing from Constance, which is a great company in China that actually launched a free BBS platform, so just about anybody can host their own BBS, which did for BBS what maybe WordPress or what Blogger did for blogging in the United States or in the West. And I think there are cultural elements too that drive people to go online to share their experience or to ask questions in China. One is there is a general distrust of the media for having telling the truth for various reasons in China. And so people, for word of mouth has always been very, very influential, very, very popular all over the world, especially in China, where to get the real story, you had to know somebody who knew somebody. And you go down to the Shaolongtang or the small lanes, hang out with the neighborhood community, and really understand what's really happening. And so there's that sense. Also, there's just, as I mentioned with automobiles, there's a lack of information overall. There's a lack of trusted information in traditional sources. Even for word of mouth, traditional sources like your parents, they're not going to help you buy a car. They're not going to help you buy a mobile phone. So I think that there are some cultural issues as well.
So the question about trust, I think, is a very interesting question. What do you think makes people trust in your respective countries what they read?
Trust is a is kind of a unique term, but you know, I'm a Korean American, so I've lived in both the U.S. and here in Korea. And as I take a look at how people interact here in Korea versus the U.S., it's actually very, very unique. In the U.S., it's very common for someone to go out to lunch by themselves, eat at a counter, and have a meal on their own. In Korea, you never see that happen. Okay. So people kind of flock together, they eat together, they eat after work. So that forms a what I call a natural, you know, community. So culturally, that's a real big difference. I've also worked in Japan for a couple of years.
And I think
in Japan, it's a hybrid model. It's right in between the US and in Korea. I see some people eating on their own. I see some people not eating on their own. So I think that as markets mature, things do change. But because of the community, there's a trust aspect. And another example is that I play a lot of tennis. And in the US, you belong to a tennis club to play. In Korea, you belong to communities of different tennis organizations. So again, that's how you get that trust on it, by interacting with other people who have very similar, you know, bonds.
Kaneko-san, how is that in Japan? Yeah. How does trust on the communities, Mixi, for instance, which you helped create, trust generated?
I had James' opinion, and I think it's similar to Japan. Mixi is anonymous service, but it's invitation only. That means we need to be connected in real world at first. That makes trust for people.
Yeah, also, you know, in a place like Korea, it's, you know, Cyber, for example, uses a real name identity version. It's never anonymous. So at the end of the day, you know who is posting the messages, who is sending out that information. So I think that that, again, caters to more of a trusting environment.
Now, is that a good or a bad thing? For instance, I remember vivid discussions with Jeff Bezos when I was working him at Amazon, that he pushed for implementing real names, which actually happened after all his CEO. And I said, but if my esteemed colleague at Stanford writes a textbook, which didn't happen, rather, writes a textbook which I thought was really bad, if I could have a pseudonym which has a history of being a competent statistician who talks about statistics textbooks in a competent way, saying, but that textbook really gets 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 wrong, I would perhaps do it, but not with my real name, because that's the last time that the guy would say hello to me on the floor door. So I think it is a very open question whether we really need the real name of people. Because think about yourselves. How many identities do you really have? There's, you know, the work identity, and there's the after hours. You know, I don't want to be too personal here, but it's no question about it that we have more than one sub-identity, if you will. So I think lots of thought is going in the United States, including Facebook, into the question about how should identity management work. And one interesting parallel between Facebook and Mixi is that it used to start in the physical world. So that's very interesting. However, in Facebook's case, it very much has shifted into the virtual world. You know, from the 300-400 friends I have in Facebook, and my pseudonym is always Ava again, so I'm not super creative about it. There are lots of people now who are my friends without actually really me knowing them. Now, the big question is, friendship is not a binary thing. When will the online companies realize that it's not only gradual, for instance, who invites whom, how long does it take me to accept, but it is also multi-dimensional. Some people might be interested in, you know, getting to know because I might want to date them. Other people might be interested because they might want to work for me. So the binary concept of having a friend, I think, is super simplistic. And what we will see is that they are multidimensional continuous variables which describe the relationship between people.
Yeah, I'll just extend that to when last time we were talking about social commerce, particularly on sites like Taobao, which is a C2C site that essentially beat eBay at its own game in China. And then you talk about trust, especially trust in commerce, not only commerce as a type of relationship. You do see that sellers, you have your experience points or your formal reputation management system and how many transactions and positive comments, negative comments, and so on. You have that just like eBay. But where we see that credibility and trust is built up more is actually in what you do on the site. Okay? And that means, because on Taobao, it's very much social commerce where people, before they make a purchase, just like when you go to a store offline, you talk to people. You talk to the salesperson, or you talk to other consumers who have the same interest in cosmetics or in the cosmetic community on Taobao that you do. You want to buy the best product, right? And so if merchants can jump into the conversation and genuinely provide value, okay, and not be overtly commercial, okay, that's actually the best way to build up trust in this very commercial and social world.
If you think about it historically, it was some dude in the United States called Henry Ford or something who had the idea that mainly things are happening within the company. That was not the case before. That's not the case in the market outside my house in Shanghai. People know each other. There are relationships. So one amazing opportunity and challenge we have now is to move from what is a transaction economics, where people do the transaction and that's it. United Airlines sells me a ticket or Korean Airlines and hey, good luck, young man. If you miss the plane, it's your problem. If we are late, it's your problem too. To relationship economics, where we really value the individual as individual, where we create a space where the individual can do things on their terms, not where the company determines on what the terms are. So, that I think Mixi, Facebook, Xiaonei in China are actually first steps where people have a sanctuary, using Shoshana Zuboff's term, where they actually are no longer the targets of advertising, the passive objects which are targeted like in military, but where they can self-express. And Sam, as you said very nicely last slide, self-explore. At the heart of all of this is communication. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why Asia is leading in many areas here. The fact that I have a WiMAX thing here at my laptop, which, until last week wasn't available in the United States, and it works like a dream here, makes me really think, why is it possible here? And what we're exploring, in some degree, are the effects of an infrastructure which makes it possible by renting it at the airport for $3 a day to have super amazing 1-point-something megabyte per second up and download speeds. So at the heart is communication, and I don't know, where do you think in the next 5 years or so that bi-directional communication, not the push media, but that bi-directional communication, the dialogue, the collaborations, where do you think that will take us? Any takers?
I think everyone's heard of the term IPTV. It's a loosely defined term that a lot of companies around the world are thinking about. But if you take a look at Korea, for example, the big telcos have already said that IPTV is going to be a big portion of their business. And Korea has such a good infrastructure that I think Korea is in a good position to be the first to really capitalize on that. But let's not forget the role of the government. If you take a look at why Korea has succeeded in this kind of a role so far, it's because of the Asian economic crisis. In 1997, I think the Korean government knew that they're no longer in the business of competing in a low-cost environment. So they really started the IT sector as a way to compete. And that's what really got them out of the Asian economic crisis. So Korean government plays a big role, and IPTV is another new frontier. Take a look at a lot of the mobile phones in Korea today. Now, you know, you can watch, you know, digital mobile broadcasting very, very quickly. So that's the new technology that it's just not available in other markets. So when you have access to that, you know, you can continue to lead.
But I would like to emphasize really the interactions, you know, not just watching TV now on my headset. I mean, who wants to watch it on this size thing? It's an interesting question. But I want to emphasize people interacting with people, people creating and co-creating, as I'm sure there must be examples in Korea. Should we invite the audience, while maybe the two of you are getting your answers, the audience with any questions, any comments you might have in the remaining 7 minutes? But Sam, do you have a comment?
Sure.
Or one of you?
Well, I think it gets down to, as I said at the end of my presentation, is, you know, how to, we talk about the relationship economics, you know, Andreas's term. Ultimately, you know, if consumers are providing value or even the platforms that are hosting these kind of conversations are providing value, they should get some compensation, right? I mean, I think that if it is about relationship economics, someone's got to pay for it. And I think that you're seeing this happening. I mean, I would see that Facebook is a potential platform for these kind of collaborative conversations. I think Amazon is a potential community or platform. You've got sites like Meme in the States, which enables a niche. The creation of niche social networks. In China, you've got sites already niche social networks like BabyTree, okay, which are topic-based communities that are bringing consumers and brands together to share. And so I think, you know, if brands are giving a set of their own platforms, maybe their private communities to engage with consumers and compensate them in one way or another, okay, either just thrill of being involved with the brand, okay? Or maybe just like a focus group, you pay them to participate. Okay? Or the platforms, the neutral platforms, will provide access charges. Just like Twitter, how's Twitter gonna monetize? Like, well, corporate membership. If they wanna participate in this very strong community, then they gotta pay for that. So I think these are all just brainstorm ideas of how the next phase could happen and how they can be monetization.
So basically what we're talking about here is, why do we do things? What are the motivations? I talked to Esther Dyson about a month ago on the Fortune Brainstorm Tech Conference about that. And Esther says, maybe it's immortality. By contributing stuff, by creating stuff on the web, there's some element which maybe complements the old idea that, you know, why do you do things? To spread your DNA. Any ideas, why do people do things online? Why do people spend their time and contribute to the community in Asia, in China, Japan, and Korea?
The thrill. I mean, that's part of it. For some people, it's the thrill, the excitement of seeing their text or their pictures or their DNA, if you will, you know, online. And the thrill of helping people or just doing something, of being part of a bigger element. So, I think, to be honest, it's a
whole
other session.
Kaneko-san, why do you think people actually contribute here? Why do you think people contribute? What are the drivers? Do they want to be part? Do they want to belong? As the Sheraton here has it as its motto.
It's a very big question for me, but I think it's kind of nature of human.
So it's human nature to want to contribute. And Jim, what do you think? Why do people contribute to Yahoo Answers or in actually interactions besides getting laid and, you know, whatever the other option?
Yeah, at the end of the day, some people are bored. You know, they need things to do. And the internet, you know, they're all the time. You want new information. You also want to share. So I think that's the real reason.
Question from the audience.
Yes, sir. One question. Social networks traditionally don't make money. They have advertising as a business model. I don't think advertising as a business model has a long-term sustainability. I would like your opinions about this. Secondly, should corporates pay for the privilege of data mining or text mining, to use Mr. Sam Fleming's cool word?
So we have just to unpack this. We have two questions. The first one is, and that can be corroborated by some of these numbers. We talked about that 0.1% click-through rates. Social networks have a hard time with advertising. Can we think of different business models, subscription-based, like carriers and so on and so forth? Anybody wants to take that question here? And then we'll get to the second one.
I'd like to explain what's happening in Japan. As a ministry, for example, the revenue of more than 60 or 70 billion US dollars from advertising revenue. And then mobile is also making revenue of about 200 billion US dollars from revenue of these SNS services. So I don't see that advertising doesn't work in the SNS market. I think the reason why they make money is using mobile phone. Mobile phone is, so we have to explain, but mobile phone is easier way for companies to advertise their revenue.
You know, if you take a look at the history of online advertising on the internet, it's really 10 years old. And in Korea, we started the overture business in 2002, right? So I think that, number one, you've got to give it some time. Number two, there's a lot of new technology that is coming out, things like behavior targeting, that really makes the advertiser kind of target the right audience. I know that with Mixi at in Japan, you know, Overture Japan did a deal with Mixi to provide sponsored search on not all of their properties, but on some of the key properties to make it a little bit more relevant. But I do think that it's only a matter of time before the real big advertisers start, having more credible access to the social networking sites. And I think that the challenge right now is this whole global economic slowdown today, which takes a real big turn on display advertising. But search will continue to be a very dominant force.
Okay, let me touch on that and then I'll answer the second question. I think it's traditional advertising may not be the best model, but you look at QQ, which is not exactly an SNS, but certainly a social internet platform, if you will. They make most of their money from selling digital goods, so it's sunglasses or clothing for the avatar, or food for your virtual pet, things like that. So, you know, and this is in a market where the average internet user makes $150 a month or somewhere along those lines. So, in a so-called foreign market. So there are ways to monetize if you step out of the box of traditional advertising. In terms of the text mining, it's a complicated question, but in a short time, I would say whoever is receiving value from the text mining should pay for it.
I think it is really that we moved beyond just mining stuff that's out there to a mindset where people actually create stuff. So I think the question about incentives, about why people do things, which might be culture sensitive, that question is becoming more and more important. And if you think about my thesis that at the heart of what we have is not primarily technology. It's not, here's the data set, give me insights, but it's, here's a problem, here's something I want to solve. Help me get the data from the people. It's really turning that pyramid, as I showed you in the Chinese slide, turning the pyramid upside down, where we try to actually, with the communication which we have now and for which Asia is leading, with that communication to connect people, as Nokia's slogan has it, and that way we can create best practices and innovation which helps us actually create knowledge. In that sense, I would very much like to thank Open Web Asia and the World Knowledge Forum for inviting us to have this panel. Thank you very much.